Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 427th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm the Director of Program and Practice Support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, and I'm a professor at the University of Alberta.
And we felt that people were sick to death of hearing us, so we brought in a good friend and colleague who's actually been on the podcast a couple of times, Mark McConnell. Mark is an internist in Wisconsin, and every month or so, he and I just chat about life and medicine and medications and all the ones that we're on. And we started to discuss a variety of things. Mark is really good at explaining thought processes when it comes to medical care, how to listen to patients, helping them make decisions, and he's a really solid diagnostician. But he's also very good at not doing what didn't need to be done. And that's sort of the title of our podcast. And Mark's been involved in a lot of things in regards to reducing the incidence of hypoglycemia with diabetes medications and so on. But most importantly, he's a good friend and a really good internist. So welcome back, Mark.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah. So I think, why don't we just jump in, because it's sort of the theme that we're going to talk about is less is more, but it's really how not to do what didn't need to be done.
Right. So, and as you said, James, this kind of grew out of our conversations where we share stories and anecdotes. And I know that a lot of the podcasts, and one of the things I love about you guys is the focus on evidence-based medicine, but you do a wonderful job of recognizing that that's not just evidence equaling decisions, that you have to factor in all those personal stories and that every patient's an individual. So we had kind of been chatting and talked about that idea of how not to do what didn't need to be done. And it's sort of come out of a maybe five-year noodling I've had about this idea.
I don't know if you want to use the word noodling, but go ahead.
I don't know what that means in Canada, but it's just the idea that, to me, it seems that one of the primary enemies of primary care is distraction.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many things happening that the patients are at risk of becoming peripheral. And a lot of this seems to be in the areas of preventing overdiagnosis, the less is more series, choosing wisely, BMJ's too much medicine series. All of those seem to be very interesting to me because they resonate a lot with experience in clinic. So there's a couple references that might be interesting. One is a New York Times article, 2012, where they talk about too many tests. And so this is 7 years ago, and they're talking about a third of the $2 trillion in the United States spent on healthcare, maybe spent on unnecessary tests and treatments and that sort of thing.
And that's an unbelievable number, really. I mean, if you think about it.
What does that mean? What does $2 trillion even mean? Mm-hmm. You know, but if we're just saying a third of it, yeah. If any business could cut their waste by a third, they'd be very interested in that. And then just as an example, just I think it was a week or two ago while we were talking in JAMA, an article that is interesting because it involves the U.S. and Canada, has talked about the increase in imaging from 2000 to 2016. So if we just look at MRI imaging, that went from, so you got to use round numbers because these articles are full of just numbers. But just to take one example, MRIs went from 60 per thousand people to 140 per thousand people in the U.S. And they went from 13 per thousand people to 89 in Canada over that 16-year period. So, you know, more than doubling.
Oh, yeah.
And,
definitely.
And the U.S. more than doubled Canada. So,
And that's the context of, you know, and clearly, some of it is useful and necessary, but, you know, so much of it isn't. And like I said, we can debate whether a third of medicine is unneeded or a quarter. It doesn't really matter whether it's 10% or 50%. What we want to do is go, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we don't need to be doing. And I think, Mike, you're very comfortable with this, is the sort of that you get distracted by doing everything else because we just don't have time to do everything.
Yeah, no, there's lots of things going on, as Mark indicated, in any primary care encounter where you're trying to sort through what's relevant information, what's not relevant. Sometimes that's difficult for us. A lot of the times it's difficult for patients because they don't have medical training. They have symptoms and they're not sure whether this symptom could correlate to the fact that they've started boating, and is it the saltwater air? There's a thousand things that go through mm-hmm. everyone's mind, and it's very complicated. And to pare that down is challenging. That's just one of the many reasons why we are ordering more and more tests all the time. And one of the pieces that I've always struggled with, this, and I think it can be part of our conversation today, is the challenge between meeting expectations and hopes of patients who often desire tests. So research shows that they desire testing and treatments, like we can talk about imaging of the back, antibiotics, and all sorts of things that they desire. And certainly even in a periodic health exam, they're hoping for more tests. And that is balanced against their desire is balanced against quality of care. And mm-hmm. it's hard to actually explain to someone that ordering these tests are potentially dangerous for you, and they're more likely dangerous than they are helpful, and that any positive result has somewhere around an 80% chance of being a false positive for many of our tests, and things like that. It becomes complicated. And so I think this will be part of our conversation. I did want to address something that Mark said very early on, which I think is important. In Canada, noodling carries a 2 to 5 year prison term. So just to let you know.
Yes, I was not noodling the last few weeks.
I thought it was canoodling, but I don't know about these things. Anyway, Mark, I'm sure that's the sort of direction that we're going to go with this podcast.
Yeah, and so as Mike says, I think we're saying the same thing. What I see is because of the time pressure and difficulty in terms of access for patients to be seen, and especially really nicely articulated by some authors in 2017, Canadian Family Practice, Allen and McCormick and Koronik and some of you other guys, mm-hmm. the article about primary care and essentially what are some of the conflicting demands in primary care. Some of the quotes: clinicians struggle with finite time and resources to incorporate the onslaught of good ideas. That's what, it's very well said. They're every idea of what program we could do or what test or what treatment is a good idea in and of itself. But the idea of putting those into the context of the patients, helping them to prioritize, getting the care to fit their capacity mm-hmm. for care is really critical, and it's very difficult. And what I see in that distraction, if you will, is people ordering things because it's frankly a lot easier to order a test or a treatment than it is to see a patient, have a long discussion. I think it takes, Mike, I'd be interested to know, to me, it takes a lot longer to discuss with a patient why not to have a test than to get the test.
Oh, yeah. It feels infinitely easier when you're in practice.
Yeah.
And even something small like a back x-ray, to really have the conversation, to allow them to understand that you're more likely to feel pain for the next, at kind of the next 3 to 6 months because we've ordered this film than we are to actually help you. That doesn't make sense. And right. So to explain how that can be, et cetera. I do want to say that Tina is the one who wrote that line that you like, Mark. I'd love it if I could take credit for it, but in reality, I remember when she wrote that in one of our versions and sent it along, and I just thought it was brilliant what she said.
I think the article is really excellent, and I would really recommend it to all the listeners, and maybe attach that to the show notes
because
it's brief and it's really, really gets to the point. And I think primary care providers will really resonate with that.
And the same thing is, and I was also going to add, and it's the same thing when it comes to antibiotics. It's much easier to give them than it is to explain why you don't need them. And it's that, and it's the same, you know, it's the same thing when, you know, how do you explain to someone that it may not be necessary to treat your blood pressure?
Right.
You know, and all those sorts of things. And that's, you know, there's so many examples of this, which is, and it's why we want to go through the process of how not to do what didn't need to be done. And you've sort of got an approach that you work with.
Right. And I wonder if it's true for you guys that you're having those conversations with patients, at what point in the dialogue with the patient do you get to the point where you feel like you're trying to convince yourself and you've lost the patient, you know?
I have to tell you this story. I remember I was trying to explain the risks and benefits of PSA screening. And so I started, and he was clearly glazing over. So I gave him a pamphlet, which I thought had a pretty good flow of the plus and minuses. He came back, and we were talking about it again. And he finally says, "Doc, just tell me, would you do it or not?" It was almost like, shut up, Mike. Just help me make this decision.
Right. Very true. Well, I think that one approach in trying to not do what didn't need to be done, and I realize that's, you know, sounds kind of judgmental, but there are lots of tests that don't need to be done, and we wind up with the results and then have to sort of unwind that care. Mm-hmm. But I think at the beginning, it begins with starting with a differential diagnosis. What could these symptoms or this presentation be representing? What are the possible causes? That I think that is the foundation of trying to approach patients. And next step that I like to do is the patient two things. Are they a candidate for the end product of what I'm going to find? So if I find a carotid stenosis, are they a candidate to have the surgery? That's an important question to ask before doing it. You focused on this in DEXA screening. Is the patient willing to take a medication for 5 years if they are found to have osteoporosis? Mm-hmm. That's a why screen for sleep apnea if someone says, I'm never going to wear a mask? These sorts of things need to be taken into account up front. And the second part factor of the patient, are they interested in it? And that gets to what you've talked about in terms of values and preferences. Mm-hmm. Is this something that's really important to them? And then the final step is really, what's the best test and, you know, to look at something. So I'm kind of limiting this at this point to diagnostics, because I think that's where we wind up with so many results that need to be addressed and explained and sometimes treated. Sometimes we follow them, you know, so that just creates a whole nother industry, if you will, of test follow-up.
Oh, and because most of our medications and treatments follow a test, and the test could be as simple as even just measuring blood pressure. But, you know, one leads to the other in a lot of circumstances.
So then I kind of think of, well, how are these decisions made? And I've been trying to find information. It's really hard to find much of anything. But there's an article in 99 in BMJ, and they talk about tables of sensitivity and specificity, Bayesian probability, and then pictorial decision trees. The whole article is beautiful, and it has not a single word about the patient involved in there. I found something even better, however, in a non-medical source from 1980. It's a Journal of Economic, Behavioral, and Organization. I'm sure I hope you have your subscription paid up to that one.
Yeah. No, I'm the editor of it.
Yeah, I like this, we've kind of touched on this, this quote called bounded rationality, the capacity of the human mind or a patient's mind for formulating and solving complex problems is very small compared to the size of the problems whose solution is required for objectively rational behavior in the real world. And I think that the more I think of it, I think that's very true in patient visits. Mm-hmm. And some patients just say, as you said, Mike, doc, tell me what to do. And that's perfectly reasonable, but we want to give them that opportunity. And then there's an author named McConnell who wrote in 2019 on the back of a napkin his theory, which are there are two kinds of patients, those that go to casinos and those that don't. And I I kind of think that that's true. When I see patients, there are some patients that say, yes, I want the PSA done. I think I'm the one that will be cured. And others that say, no, I don't want that done. I know I'd be the person that had side effects. And I don't know if that's how people go to casinos or not. I don't go to casinos. I figure I'm always going to lose. I don't buy lottery tickets. But there are people that do, and maybe they think they're going to be the winner. And I don't know if that's a valid concept or not. I tried to find some information about that. But it seems to hold true in practice that it's hard for me to predict which of those types of patients I'm going to have in front of me. But it's critical that I try to find out.
Oh, yeah. And you can never figure out, you know, some people have an inordinate fear about certain things, and some people have have no fear about anything. And so you literally can't tell without just having that a little bit of a conversation about it. And often there's a behind their fears or lack of fears is another whole other topic that, you know, when you're talking to people about why they have all these things. So yeah, you have to have that conversation. Otherwise you're just doing what you think is best, which is sometimes close to what the patient is thinking, but can be drastically different.
Right. Right. Very true. So the points, that I think just sort of some isolated topics, this idea of, you know, why are we worried about these tests is really a nice demonstration in JAMA in 2019. The article is about the cascade effect of preoperative electrocardiograms for cataract surgery, which is universally known to not be of value. You don't need to have an EKG prior to cataract surgery. But they looked at what happened as people got these routine EKGs before cataract surgery. And it really nicely spells out what we all see daily. It leads to other things. You have something abnormal there. Someone has a left anterior hemi block. Well, you say the word block to a person who has a heart, and they're thinking heart blockages, and their mind is locked on that, you know, and it leads to more tests. And they show very nicely how we waste a lot of time and effort. And, of course, there are going to be iatrogenic problems. But even if the patients don't have a physical problem, there is the downside of a waste of their time and the opportunity cost for not seeing someone else or not providing some other service. So that's just – do you have any thoughts on that, guys?
Well, this is one of the things that – kind of, I'm writing a Tools for Practice right now on TSH screening, and I've written one on CBC screening and all of that kind of thing. And I've done a fair amount of looking, and the cascade effect is something that we often don't think about. That, you know, this patient isn't symptomatic, but you order a TSH and it's 8, let's say. Now you're wondering, I ordered that purely for screening. Now I'll bring them back and say to them things like, are you fatigued? And if you ask any of us if we're tired at any point, the answer is yes. And so you've got some vague symptoms, which research shows, for example, that thyroid, people who are euthyroid have almost the same number of thyroid complaints as those who are hypothyroid. So it becomes really tricky to sort out. So you retest them and you order their T4 and T3 to make sure that that's normal. Then you recall them in 6 months and retest it to make sure it's not going in a certain direction. And you see, and then you start thinking like, well, maybe I should examine the thyroid. You do. What is it? So I order an ultrasound and now they've got a bump there. And you're into this cascade where you're likely harming these people. And you've been distracted from likely what the patient needs you to do for them. And so these are, I find the whole idea of opening the door with testing in asymptomatic people a very dangerous thing. And I think it distracts us because now I'm busy with this and I'm not, or I'm busy following up on all my test results from over-ordering, and I don't feel comfortable fitting in, you know, two other people today who actually have acute problems like a rolled over ankle or you know, the serious loss of a loved one or something like that. Like things that I could actually maybe help a little bit more with rather than stirring up a hornet's nest.
Yeah. And we've talked about this before about even just lab tests. I mean, with TSH, I mean, I hope people appreciate that if the TSH does not change by 40 to 50%, you actually can't be sure that it's changed because of the analytic and biological variation of it. And so you know, that's quite something when it comes to that. But yeah, no, it's a great example. And I think it's very similar to what you talked about with cataract surgery.
Well, a hemoglobin, you know, you measure hemoglobin and it's 125, and then you remeasure and it's 119, and all of a sudden you think, man, this guy's gone down in his hemoglobin. But
yeah, it has
certainly, like even a closer range, like 121, and now it's at the cutoff that it's below 120, it's 119, and you think, oh, is this? And what you do there is you remeasure it in hopes that it gets into the normal range by fluke.
Yeah,
and then you can stop it, but you should never have started.
Yeah, and then measure and never measure it again.
My experience is it never gets stopped.
Yeah.
Really,
exactly. It never gets stopped. Then you worry that they're right at the border, so you reschedule one for next year. Yeah,
I think two other examples are very common that I see, and that is ejection fractions in people with heart failure. And the variation on an ejection fraction, an echocardiogram, is plus or minus 10%, asking the best cardiologists. And so we report these in single digits, and patients say, you know, my ejection fraction was 37% and now it's 41%, and I'm so happy. And if it goes the other way, which is a meaningless difference, you know, they're hanging black crepe paper. And the other is with renal function. And, you know, when it was creatinine, that was one thing. But with the estimated glomerular filtration rate, that's easy for you to say. I think that it's, you know, people come in and say, my kidneys are at 25% and they were 27% 6 months ago. What's happening? It's very hard to help get them unfocused on those precise numbers that aren't really valid in terms of true interpatient variability.
No, exactly.
Well, there's a couple of diagnoses that I don't look for that I thought I'd mention. Mm-hmm. And you guys have mentioned these. You know, one is pre-hypertension. The other is pre-diabetes or metabolic syndrome. And now a more recent one, and I'm not entirely sure I'm not going to look for this one, but it's non-alcoholic fatty liver disease.
Oh,
nice. In JAMA 2019, but my approach to all three of those disease states, if we will, or we'll call them states of less than perfection, is that never has my advice to a patient changed upon finding one of those pre-diagnoses. That is, I can't imagine my recommendations to a patient changing at all, whether I find pre-diabetes, pre-hypertension, or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. I don't know what are your thoughts on that?
These
are all conditions that I disdain, and I don't ever talk about metabolic syndrome. I dislike it for similar reasons to James. Maybe I haven't made fun of it quite as much, but it is terrible that we've done this to people. And then pre-hypertension, that's another awful one. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, I've been to a number of talks and everyone has a slightly different approach to it. And I don't know that any of us have a great approach. And I also worry that for the same things that you've talked about, are we overcalling these things, getting people to over worry when we don't really know what the true risk is for them and what interventions we actually have other than.
I would argue the interventions are going to be the same.
Yeah, they're going to. Well, the intervention is lifestyle. And and would you not offer that same condition? I have seen one patient with this condition who I did tell about it that actually changed his lifestyle for a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
It went back, but it for a year and a half, it did change considerably, but then, it did go back. So that's a challenge.
Well, then I thought maybe we could just sort of contrast two cases, if you don't mind.
Go ahead. Because
I think they kind of illustrate some of these concepts, and it's just a patient that I'd seen that this gentleman is 84, had sciatica, was seeing a specialist about pain. And the specialist, for some reason, listened to his carotids and his heart. and found that he had a carotid bruit and a cardiac murmur, and referred him to me to get a carotid ultrasound and a cardiac echocardiogram. And he ordered those tests. So this 84-year-old, who is not a candidate to have really any surgery based on his overall health state, and that's why I go back to the decision analysis, is the patient a candidate for what I might find? So first of all, he's asymptomatic from the carotid artery standpoint, so the findings on the carotid ultrasound are going to be meaningless in terms of affecting care. We're not going to operate. And this patient was already getting optimal medical therapy with statin, blood pressure control, and aspirin. And he had a cardiac echo done, which showed mild aortic stenosis, for which he had no symptoms and no intervention was going to be needed. So it just kind of points out how, and so it took up an hour of my time explaining all of this to him, which I don't mind, but he didn't need either of the tests done. And he had a whole lot of anxiety, he and his family, wondering about this. Now they're worrying about the risk of stroke and heart attack, which, you know, we don't have anything we can do other than what he's already doing to lower the risk for. And to me, those kinds of situations really are heartbreaking, that we're, hate to say it, but we're almost inflicting suffering on patients if we're not careful.
Oh, yeah. And the, you know, the, there's, you know, while the... There's a big, it sometimes sounds like we're, you know, we're torturing patients, but really the intervention versus torture, the only difference is intent.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I I'm not disagreeing with you. It is funny, but the level of difference in intent is profound.
Oh, I would not, I think the word profound is very reasonable, but it's, yeah.
The specialist who did that, like, I don't doubt that he or she had their heart absolutely in the right place. We better find out for this guy what's going on, and maybe we can do something, or, you know. And it reminds me of The Simpsons, which I know you like, Mark, is where Dr. Hibbert says to Homer, we can find out what's wrong. We just can't do anything about it. And that's when he says, what an age we live in.
Modern age.
So
it's like this is one of those situations where a little bit of time up front, judiciously not ordering the tests, the patient would have had, one could argue, a better lifestyle and peace of mind, certainly not have had two more specialty visits and another consultation with me and the added time and driving. And after all, he's 84 and not in good health to begin with. And his original problem was sciatica. So I doubt spending a lot of time in the car driving back and forth to doctor's offices was exactly what he desired. I guess, I don't mean to be tongue in cheek, but these things are very sad. And I think that unless we really take a step back and ask ourselves, what are we doing? It's very tough in this distracted world of primary care to do anything other than order the test, because that it does not take as much time. So here's the contrast. You know, I talked about the casino goers and the non-casino goers. So serendipitously, I saw a 78-year-old gent a week or two later after this patient who had the carotid ultrasound, and I'd never seen him before. At 77, he'd had asymptomatic carotid artery screening for some reason. And obviously, we know the literature does not support that. That cohort does not benefit from surgery for even if he has a carotid stenosis. Well, on the ultrasound, the tech thought they saw a shadow in the apex of the lung. Sure enough, he had a spiculated mass. He had surgery and had a surgical cure of lung cancer. So he's absolutely grateful and says that carotid ultrasound saved my life. There's the patient that goes to the casino, and they go home from the casino, also known as a hospital, and say, make sure you get a carotid ultrasound done because it'll find lung cancer. It saved my life. And we've all seen this, you know, with
absolutely.
And I'm not discrediting any of that. I'm only bringing that up to point out this is the dynamic the atmosphere in which we practice, it's not just, oh, the studies show that doesn't benefit, so I'm not doing it and you can't have it. No, there's all kinds of emotional, anecdotal, one-off types of examples that patients have as a part of their culture and their history that we have to be sensitive to. It's a tough one.
And it's also culture within medicine, Mark. So let's say I'm a regular screener with mammography, and a couple of patients have been picked up in my practice in their early 40s with breast cancer over my career, let's say, or even over 15 years, and it was intervened. Now, you and I know that might not be a real breast cancer. It might never have evolved. Maybe the intervention didn't make a difference because the person ended up, it was metastatic already. There's a thousand things. But at the time of finding and curing in our minds, we become, you know, it is hard to erase that from your memory.
Yes.
Even when you have, like, well, I went for a breast biopsy and I had this infection and it was awful for 2 weeks and nothing was ever found. And we have all of those cases as well. But the one you saved is very hard. And I remember having a patient who we found a tumor on mammography. It was ductal carcinoma in situ. And I tried to talk to her that, you know, after the surgery, because she was kind of going around like a, you know, breast cancer was obviously a huge deal and all of that stuff. And I was saying that cancer, I'm glad it's out and all of those things, but we don't know for certain whether it would have been a problem for you in the long term. It's safer that it's out. I'm glad that for you, but we don't know. And so I don't want you to kind of let it rule your life and all of those things. And she still, even after I said all of that, she's like, "You saved my life, Dr. Allen."
That's right.
And it's hard to separate those. And I tried once. I didn't ever bring it up with her again because I don't think that that's fair. But this is a, you know, the argument you're making is a good sound one, and it's something that I definitely preach from the pulpit too. But there is so much gray around this area that clouds us, even with, as you said, the good having good evidence and the best intentions. There's a lot of gray here that makes it more challenging in practice than a lot of us can imagine, I think.
So yeah, and I think I would sum that up just to say the ratio of the latter case to the former case is like the ratio of lottery winners to lottery losers, and we have to be aware of how many people are losing out. And they often don't know that they didn't need the test done, so they don't think the system is broken. We are the ones who should know whether or not
absolutely we're
stewards. And I think this is relevant to two topics that are very hot topics, at least in the U.S. One in primary care is access. Are there appointments available for patients? And burnout. And so I think that, and Mayo did a nice study showing more than 50% of clinicians are suffering from burnout. I think that was last year. So, you know, I think leadership wants patients to be seen. They want them to have appointments. I don't know how much we're looking at what they're really having access to. Is there enough time in these encounters for the patients to have access to a really individualized plan of care? And the burnout, I think, comes, you see enough patients and you're having to undo care, unwind care. That's a lot of burnout, because we went into this to try to help people, not to just sort of do remedial work on the back end of things that didn't need to be done. And that's why I'm interested in this. So what's the impact of doing what doesn't need to be done, you know, on access and burnout? Has it even been studied? What's the contribution to burnout from these things? I couldn't find anything really in the literature, because I think it'd be very hard to study. But I do like this quote that I got from, again, this was dealing with the energy literature and how people choose how to utilize energy from 2015. So I'm just going to substitute medical instead of like the choices about energy. Mm-hmm. Though not reliably predicted by either environmental concerns or material interests, individuals' choices around medical behavior and resource consumption are in fact predictable. They are predictably irrational. I think that we can try to think that these decisions are going to follow a formula. And at the beginning, I think you said, yeah, Mark has an approach. Yeah, I have an approach. It's predictably irrational. I think we got to individualize and be listening and explore patients' values, find out what makes them tick, because that's going to lead us closer to what aligns with their values. So,
I don't know about you guys. I know certain, and this is purely anecdotal. There's no evidence or studies that I've ever seen is that, you know, Mike, you and I, and we've done a lot of education stuff. We've, you know, encouraged the concept of understanding evidence and shared decision making. And I can't tell you how many people who, you know, maybe a year later or 2 years later came back and said, you know what, I've started to do a little bit of this where I'm actually talking to patients about the numbers and so on. And it is hard work. It is difficult, but I am enjoying my practice in a way that I had not for years. And I don't know if that is, it's clearly not everybody, and it's clearly not, you know, for every specialty, but there's so many anecdotes of people who go, the people who really weren't looking and were just, you know, following the guidelines and so on, that they get an appreciation. I know, Mark, you're sort of a great example of the value that you personally get of doing the approach that you're talking about.
Right. I personally burn out when I'm just doing rote stuff. Mm-hmm. What is absolutely exhilarating is the maybe 1 out of 10, I estimate, encounters where there is a connection. And you guys know what this is like. Be fruity. It's spiritual. There is a real connection. When you really communicate with someone and you're on the same wavelength, I think that's where the healing occurs. Even if there isn't physical healing, there is validation and the patient feels valued. So I noticed, though, James, you said something like purely anecdotal. And I wonder why, even though I want to be a scientist, every time I'm on these podcasts, it always winds up just being purely anecdotal. It's just my... I got nothing.
Yeah, no, you know, but like you started started the podcast with the same thing. Is it's not just about the evidence; it's about the stories, and much of what we have just been doing is talking about stories. But what we really try to encourage is we sure help, if you're gonna, you know, write a story or tell a story. At least if you know in the background a reasonable appreciation of the evidence, absolute numbers, what the potential false positives, false negatives, and all those sorts of things, it really makes the story and will allow that story to be more realistic versus just purely anecdotal or purely just emotional-based medicine. And I think that's the key thing that we're trying to get across. But as you mentioned, evidence doesn't make decisions. It just helps inform them.
And I don't think you have to know the exact number. I just think you have to know that there is a number.
Yeah.
You know, that I think that's the more important concept. Yeah.
And if you think you know the exact number, you've misstepped one of what we've just talked about.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Well said.
So anything else, Mark, that you want to bring up? Because I think we could literally go into every one of these topics in detail, and talk about them. But we're trying to sort of get just a general approach to this. And like I said before, I know, you know, from talking to you probably whatever it was, you know, I don't know how many years ago, but at least a decade, about how your practice fundamentally changed when you got into doing this.
2004 I met you guys. And I would say this, we talked the other day, and it's a shameless plug for what you guys do. And we'd mentioned this phrase that came to me called clinical compassion. And maybe I'll just end with that. Mm-hmm. Meaning that the clinical side, I take that as I need to study this stuff and I should be diligent and conscientious about informing myself of the numbers that you guys make very palatable and easy to digest. That's the clinical part. So I need to know that there isn't good evidence to screen a 78-year-old for asymptomatic carotid stenosis. The compassion side is being willing to throw those things out when they need to be thrown out and value what the patient wants, even if it may not make sense. Having one without the other, I think, is the problem. You can have people that know all the numbers and are not able to contextualize it for a patient and communicate. And you can have people that are very, very nice and very kind, but are uninformed. And I think either of those options is unwise, and it's irresponsible to present that to patients. I think we need a blending of the clinical compassion.
Yeah, and I'm gonna quote a very famous person who said, "I would rather know evidence and try to apply it to each patient than memorize guidelines and try to apply them to all patients." And that was you, Mark. You said that a while ago, and I very, very much agree with it. And I know, Mike, you would support that sort of concept of, you know, applying the evidence when you have the time and the, when it's the appropriate scenario to do that.
Yeah, we obviously, as part of our group, we're now writing guidelines, even though we struggled to kind of whether we wanted to go that route, but we are writing them now. And when I hear people quoting my guideline and kind of maybe they're frustrated by a recommendation because they have a patient who fits outside of that, for goodness sake, yes, it fits outside of that recommendation. These recommendations, by far, not every single one, but by far, are malleable, mm-hmm. and they're not dogmatic. And so, you know, just like the evidence, just like everything else, when you hear a recommendation that isn't fitting the patient in front of you, don't feel like, you know, it's that you're violating a code of ethics for most of the kind of guideline recommendations we have. Like, I think, James, you'd agree that we're making recommendations that are, you know, we think are the best for the average patient.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't, on average, we don't see average patients.
Yeah. Right.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to add, and with some of the guidelines that we're putting out, I mean, the key feature, and you made this very clear to me a number of years ago, is, you know, we are creating thresholds for discussion, not thresholds for treatment necessarily. And that is a fundamentally different way of thinking about, you know, conditions for which we treat on the basis of a threshold, which is a lot of what we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So any other words of wisdom that you guys want to bring up? I love this discussion. It's all about what we're trying to do and have been trying to do for, I don't know, at least 70 or 80 years now. And Mark, I really appreciate your sensitivity to all these things. And I think you're a wonderful example of that it can be done. You don't do it perfectly. Nobody does it perfectly. But one can do this. And it is possible to have an impact on how not to do what didn't need to be done, because with some of your examples, a lot of stuff didn't need to be done. So you either don't do it, or if you are going to do it, then work hard to explain why we didn't need to do it in the first place.
Right.
So anything else, Mike?
No, nothing for me. I was going to say, I used to teach when I was teaching residents regularly, I used to ask them all the time, what do you think, you know, the proportion of your practice is evidence-based? What proportion do you think of my practice is evidence-based? And it was always way, way higher than what I thought it was. Mm-hmm. So I would remind them that I think I'm batting around at 10%. and they were always shocked by that. And sometimes it's that we don't know the evidence and there's other mm-hmm. hurdles, but sometimes it's that this patient just doesn't match the evidence, even, you know, remotely closely. And mm-hmm. so evidence-based decision making is very much the definition by Sackett. You know, it's patients, experience, and evidence combined. It's not evidence at the exclusion of all.
Yeah, no, exactly. So anyway, we hope for the listeners that you've appreciated some of the inner, you know, the discussions that we've had. You know, it's sort of the softer side of evidence. And but Mark, I really appreciate you coming on, and we will definitely have you back. Because I think there's a lot of thoughtful insight to what we're doing, because Mike and I don't have any of that. So
thank you very much.
So it's very much appreciated. So I'll just say thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.